Hello everybody, it's Wednesday and that means it's time for another edition of the HTXT.AfriCast. Once again, we've got something a bit special for you this week. Rather than listening to us HTXT staffers drone on into microphones, we have a special guest. But first, let me introduce Nick Cowan.
Hello.
And joining us on the line on Skype, you may know him from Twitter, is Nick Hall. Hi Nick, how are you?
Good. Hello.
I think we're going to have to differentiate between Nicks and Nicks here.
Okay, well, why don't we just call me Boss?
Okay,
and all right. Nick will be Nick.
All right, so I'll just call you Boss then. Yeah. All right, so today...
Yes, Boss.
Today we're going to be talking about the Cybercrimes Bill, which is a very difficult to understand piece of legislature if you haven't been keeping up with it. So...
We should also just jump in at this point and say why we're talking about it.
Yeah.
The reason being is, well, Nick, you can probably tell us, tell our listeners better than I can. How long has this bill been doing the rounds? How long is it?
So I think the first draft of the bill was made available in 2013. And then sort of 2015 was sort of a finalized version. But that got rejected, and now in 2017 we have a new, spanking brand new version of the bill, which is meant to be passed, but it's problematic, say the least.
Now, one of the reasons we're talking about this is because we got a missive from Michelson last week about how the deadline for public input for the bill has been extended. And the thing that pricked up my ears and got me to phone Nick last week for the story we wrote was the title of the email was "The Cybersecurity and Cybercrimes Bill is back, and it's worse than ever." Now, let's take it through one step at a time. Nick, what basically does this bill aim to do, and why is it problematic?
Okay, so I think when sort of discussing any piece of legislation that comes through, it's always important to bear in mind sort of the intention of the legislature, and then you try to weigh up, well, if that was their intention, what does the bill actually then do? And then sort of that's a great way of sort of defining how well the bill or the piece of law has met the intentions, and it also allows you to define or sort of identify where there are problems. So off the bat, let's just say that this is a necessary piece of law. This is something that we've been waiting for a very long time. And it's meant to sort of bulk up the provisions of the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, which was passed in 2002. And that is the only reference we have to any form of cybercrime. And it basically, it just makes hacking, which is very, very sort of loosely defined. That is the only cybercrime that we currently have in the country. Okay. And obviously, as our lives are becoming more digital, businesses are moving into a more digital environment, there is a need now to start legislating and regulating what people can do on those networks, especially since criminals are resorting to cyber means, for lack of a better word, of committing crimes. So South Africa is one of the highest instances, for example, of identity theft in the world. And that is mostly facilitated through the internet, through phishing emails, through fake websites. Something which has become fairly popular in sort of recent years is this idea of ransomware. So where people sort of completely lock you out of your information systems and then basically say, well, if you want it back, you have to pay us a whole bunch of money.
Right.
And while there is an argument to say that our existing laws of extortion and fraud kind of fit, you know, you could adapt these those existing common law crimes or existing crimes to fit what is happening in an online environment, and where possible, we should do that. But often they're not fit for purpose. They don't quite get the nuance of what's going on. And you're basically leaving it up for a judge or a magistrate to decide, well, in this instance, does this actually apply? You know, does this act of ransomware actually amount to extortion given everything else? And so what the bill is trying to do is trying to say, well, look, we've got these now, and the original 2015 version introduced something like 58 new crimes.
Right, gee.
Which was one of the problems with it. I mean, it was complete overkill. And they scaled that back quite significantly now in the latest 2017 version. I think we're down to sort of 27-odd. I'll need to check, but I mean, that's sort of where we are.
Right.
So it's a lot better, and a lot of the stuff is important. So there's things like ransomware. There's things like hacking is given a lot more scope, because it now just defines, well, there's a difference between trying to hack into someone's personal computer and somebody trying to hack the JSE, for example.
Yes.
Those are different levels of hacking, and the sentences attached to that are obviously different. Fake news. Essentially, we now have a crime to prosecute. Well, if this bill would be passed, we have the crime to prosecute the distribution of fake news. Revenge porn. Mm. All these sort of things which have become sort of blemishes on the online environment and social media, this is what the act is trying to do.
Right.
And so, you know, on the face of it, this is a good thing, I think. And I think most people can say, yes, cool.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, we should be supporting this. Absolutely. The problem comes in now is that when you start looking at, okay, well, if that's what they've intended to do, if you go and start looking at the nuances of the bill and the writing of the bill, how well have they actually been able to do this? And this is where we start running into problems. And I think sort of where I'm particularly interested is in my particular field of law. I'm interested in social media and marketing. And so I often sort of run up to with issues around freedom of speech, satire, parody, and sort of abuse online through Twitter, through Facebook, revenge porn, all that sort of stuff. So that's sort of really my focus, and the bill does go is a lot more thorough than that. But one of the things that they do, for example, is they talk about, well, if you come into possession of data that was illegally acquired, that is a 10-year prison sentence. And on the face of it, you think, okay, well, that's good. Surely if you are in possession of illegally acquired data, you should probably be punished for that.
Except when it comes to whistleblowers, I would assume.
Well, exactly. And this is the problem is that there is no defense for public interest, for example. So if we think about sort of the Gupta emails and sort of the mass, those were illegally acquired. There's no way that the person who originally acquired them did so in a lawful manner. And by that, and this also is what we mean by lawful is defined within the bill. And that's basically without permission. So there's no way that they got permission from the Guptas or from the various state ministers where the emails were got from the email servers. They did that without permission. So that means that they were automatically, those emails are unlawful. And in terms of this bill, they would then, possession of that data would be a crime. The person who actually obtained it initially and spread it, that is a crime. And what's interesting is, for example, is it's not just that you possess data that's illegally acquired. There's another crime that says where it's suspected that the data that you are possessing has been illegally acquired. That in itself is a crime as well, and it only carries the year of, you know, five years as opposed to 10-year sentence. But still, that's dubious. And we would hope, and sort of this is one of the complaints that was originally raised in the 2015 bill, is that this idea that there should be a public interest defense, that we should be protecting whistleblowers. And one of the big concerns that I have is that should this become law, it's going to have a chilling effect, especially in sort of the large media corporations and even smaller outlets. You know, are they really going to say, well, is it worthwhile me risking criminal prosecution to publish the story or to accept the story? And then people who would potentially want to whistleblow, this is something else that, you know, they have no protection now. It's like, okay, well, not only is there going to be this whole ruckus, which they will be the focus of, but there's a very real chance that they could suffer 10 years in jail for that.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a huge concern. Now, I would like to think, obviously, should a case like this, should a whistleblower ever actually get to court, the judge or the magistrate would clearly see that, you know, it's against public interest for this person to be prosecuted, and they would dismiss it. But, you know, it can take 2 to 3 years for a crime to reach to make it that far. Yeah. And if you're denied bail for that, you know, that's 2 to 3 years that you're now waiting in prison before you're cleared. So, you know, even if you may in the long run be acquitted or have the charges dropped, especially when the National Prosecuting Authority's independence is in question, that's a lot of damage that can potentially happen to you. And it also flows from the powers that the NPA and the police would now have to investigate cyber crimes. I mean, they could literally say, well, we suspect that you've got data on your servers that has been illegally acquired. We're going to take all of your computers.
Right.
You know, so they could come into any business and just say, okay, all your computers belong to us now. Goodbye. You know, there's no requirement for them to efficiently and quickly process that. They could just literally cripple an organization on suspicion that there's illegally acquired data.
So
and
so if I
not sorry. Assisting the police is then also a crime. Right. So you can potentially, you know, be guilty of 3 to 4 crimes in sort of one single spate.
So if I understand you correctly, one of the, I mean, there are so many problems, obviously, about what you've just told us. I don't even know where to start. But one of the most chilling aspects of this seems to be that the way the cyber crimes bill is being written, it's been written in such, and this may not have been the original intention, but an aspect that it could have if it goes into law in its current state is people who are, you know, investigative journalists, people who are whistleblowers, you know, people who voice dissent may not even bother to do any of those things in the first place, just because the uphill battle that they face, should they be taken to task, is just too immense.
Yes, exactly. And I think, I mean, you said something there that's quite interesting, and it's having been involved in a number of sort of controversial bills and sort of fighting them, either in my professional capacity or through the nonprofit that I run. What I have found quite alarming is that we see again and again the same provisions that were previously found problematic from a different bill being inserted into a new bill. So if we talk about sort of that acquisition of data and sort of that illegally holding of data, that's almost copied and pasted from the state secrecy bill, which you may remember, it came out around at the same time as when Poppy was initially tabled.
Yeah.
And sort of there's a confusion between the Protection of Personal Information Act and the Protection of Information Act, which is the state secrecy bill.
Yeah.
Now, provisions in the cybercrime bill are almost exactly the same as those that were in that state secrecy bill.
Yeah.
And they were a problem back then. I've seen it with the Films and Publications Amendment bill as well, for example, is that there are provisions there that really shouldn't be in there. They have no place. But it's a fairly obscure piece of legislation. It's a department that many people don't particularly give a crap about. So if you were a conspiracy theorist, you know, there is an argument to say is that there seems to be a deliberate effort by members of the executive or the legislature to try and pass these bills and these provisions with bills, fully knowing that the intention will always be to abuse them, even though that's never, you know, so they're deliberately leaving them open-ended. They're deliberately leaving them broad and vague to allow state resources to be used to basically control the flow of information or to prevent political activism.
Okay.
And I think the most, and this, you know, I say conspiracy theories, but we've actually seen this before. If you recall the spear, the painting of the spear, a couple of years ago. Now, that was pulled down. That was confiscated by the Films and Publications Board. And, you know, on the basis is that, well, it needed to be classified. Now, the sort of the Films and Publications Board Act allows them to do that. They do have the jurisdiction, if a complaint is levied, to rate a piece of artwork, which, I mean, I think is hugely problematic, but it is what it is. Hmm. But, you know, they gave it a 16 age rating, and it took them like 3 weeks to do it.
Right.
But, I mean, let's think about this, really. Like, no one actually legitimately thinks that a piece of artwork should be given an age restriction, right?
No.
I mean, that's kind of bizarre. And, I mean, it's the fact that they gave it a 16 rating itself is interesting because, in terms of our law at least, there is actually no requirement then to prevent anybody under the age of 16 seeing that. It's only if it was given an 18 rating would that be, you know, then becomes legal to let minors see it. But a 16, that's still at the parental, you know,
level.
But it was definitely used to protect the president. That's why they did it. And it's that, that's the concern that I have, is that, and I think my concern is shared by a lot of other people, is that if the current provisions in the bill are allowed to stand as they were, they will be abused.
Yeah.
We know that they will. You know, the faith in the executive to not do it has simply been far too eroded over time.
Yeah.
And there's no confidence that they won't do it. So it becomes incredibly important.
Well,
that we try and nip these in the bud and close them down.
Yeah. Well, just listening to you talk about how certain parts of the legislation that's making its way not only into this bill but into several other bills is copy and pasted from the Protection of Information Act, which is kind of – I mean, it's still sitting in Zuma's desk drawer, isn't it? It hasn't been signed into law yet.
Yeah, no. So it's been passed and then that it's gone through that final step.
Yeah.
And then it just requires – the president to sign it and promulgate it in order for it to be law, which is the same as Poppy, funny enough. I mean, that's also gone through that. That's, again, a very necessary piece of legislation. And that's actually a good bill. I mean, I don't think I have any complaints about that. But again, it's just kind of waiting there. So that there's the threat there. But I think there's been such an outcry over it. And I think, I mean, from my dealings with the state legal department, they're tired of losing battles in court, of getting laws, you know. So, like, it's something like the, you know, if we take the cybercrimes and cybersecurities world, I mean, that this has been in sort of the pipeworks now for close on to 7 years.
Right.
And then to have it completely scrapped or thrown out by the Constitutional Court because it's unconstitutional, they, you know, they really don't want that to happen. So, on the one hand, you know, they're and sort of, I think we'll get to this in terms of why people should care about this and why we're talking about this now and the mechanisms that you can use to fight this, why that becomes incredibly important. But yeah, it's kind of, we're in this weird limbo. I think the president knows that if he tried to promulgate the secrecy bill, he knows it would be thrown out of court. And yeah. I think politically they're already in a sensitive position in terms of the internal ANC factionalism and, you know, whether that would be, given the outcry, would there not be ammunition for his detractors to be able to maybe leverage against him? So, no, but if he were to win again, let's say he were to remain president of the ANC, right. You know, there's 4 or 5 years before this election process comes through again. So then's an excellent time to pass all the laws that you've kind of been sitting on your desk, and there's not really anything else that people can do about it. So that is an aspect of it, I think, is that, but you know, you need to get it to that final process, and then you kind of have an ace in the hole that you can, when you need to, be able to pass into law or to put it at a time when people are distracted by other issues.
So, Nick, a question I want to ask you is, we saw last week CNN went after a meme maker of a meme, a maker of a meme that Donald Trump tweeted out. Would we see something worse than that happening on the back of a bill such as this? Would people that make memes that mock the president or say something about the Guptas, would they be in trouble with a bill such as the cybercrimes bill?
As it currently stands, they would. There's one of the crimes, I think it's in Section 13, talks about the distribution of data, and data is very broadly defined to include pictures, sound, images, video, whatever, so,
yeah.
You know, a meme, that is harmful. And harmful...
That's very broad.
But it's defined in the Act. They say, well, in terms of this subsection, harmful means... And, you know, incitement to violence, calling on to destroy property. Then it also sort of, at the end there, it says, causes psychological, emotional harm. So it's very easy. That's a fairly low threshold. And we've actually seen that passed in the Protection of Harassment Bill Act, which is also a very good piece of legislation. So they kind of know that that wording is not problematic, but it means, but essentially that someone could, you know, so Donald Trump or Zuma could say, well, you've spread this meme about me. It's hurt my feelings. That is grounds for me now to institute criminal proceedings against you.
Wow,
that's... which would have, you know, and again, like, there's no defense there. There's no defense for parody or satire or, again, public interest, which we would hope to see.
Yeah.
And the court may read it in, but, you know, you're kind of hoping that the judge that then sees your case or the magistrate will say, yeah, okay, actually, no, this is absurd. You know, you should never be prosecuted for this sort of thing. But, you know, is that a risk that you're willing to take?
Yeah.
Not to mention that the wheels of justice in this country turn very slowly. So are you prepared to sit in jail for 6 months to 3 years waiting for your court date? So yes, I mean, and that's one of the provisions that that we've sort of raised concern about, is that harmful.
Yeah.
What are this harmful messages? Or,
can I try? Okay. Let me ask you a question that may sound like it's coming from the tinfoil hat brigade, but seeing as we're down the rabbit hole, let's give it a whirl. You said that like a lot of the legislation from that's landing up in these bills is being copied and pasted from the Protection of Information Act, which, as you said, has not been signed into law. But you also said that, like, if it gets signed into law, the first place it's going to be heading towards is the Constitutional Court, which will probably throw it out. Do you think that the legislature or the authorities are taking a kind of, the best way I can describe it is a Voltron approach to this legislation, where they essentially assemble parts of different laws that they want to get through, and they just basically shove them into bills that are currently going through the House, so that by the end there is a provision for what they want to accomplish with the Protection of Information Act. They just don't need that act tied up in one particular piece of legislation, so it's in less danger to the court. And obviously taking three bills through the Constitutional Court is going to be way more expensive and way more time-consuming than just targeting one.
So, yes, but I think I think it's important to understand how laws are made. And it's not... So often what will happen, depending on the type of law, is it's not actually Parliament who writes it. It'll be shunted off to a subcommittee, or if there is a state of government or an arm of government or branch of government that it directly relates to, they will be tasked with writing the law.
Mm.
That will then be sent to Parliament, to the subcommittee that is in charge of it, and they then need to go through the process and try and vet it, and that is the process. So, to me, the problem isn't actually with the legislature. The committees that I have seen involved in this process have been very thorough, have raised numerous issues with them, and more often than not have sort of either, you know, not given the bill their stamp of approval, or turned it away, or forced the people who drafted it, which normally lies in the executive branch of government, so not the legislature.
So
yes, it's happening, but it's not necessarily the legislature. There may be elements in the legislature, just as there are elements in the executive that are trying to do this. But, you know, when it happens three or four times, surely that's not a coincidence, right? I mean, and I think that Voltron approach is very much is that we see clauses or bills being passed into different pieces of legislation. And it does often raise the question, like, what is this doing here? This has nothing to do with what the bill is trying to do. And it's like, and then you look at it, and it's like, but I've seen this before. Yes, this came from this other bill. And it's not necessary, but, you know, I think for some of those provisions, I think it definitely is. I think there is some malice, or there is some deliberate cause behind it. But in other instances, like if we look at the revenge porn provisions that are inside the cybercrime cybersecurities bill, this is the third time we've seen those. I mean, and this is good. Like, there's no dispute that that particular provision is necessary and needed and wanted. But it's currently in three bills before Parliament now.
Mm.
It's in the Films and Publications Amendment Bill. It's in the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Amendment. And aspects of it are in the copyright bill. Now, you know, that's, it's kind of bizarre. Like, we agree that this is necessary. One of these bills should probably be passed, hopefully. But, you know, why is it across and in broadly different pieces of legislation, you know? I don't know if it's just sloppy drafting. I don't know if there is a sort of a laziness on behalf of the people writing the laws, or if there is a deliberate malicious intent there. It's difficult to say. It happens so frequently now that I think there is some merit to say that there is a deliberate attempt to get certain pieces of or certain clauses into legislation. And, you know, it's coming into more and more sort of obscure pieces of legislation as well. But thankfully, I think the parliamentary committees that are in charge of allowing the bills to progress have, for the most part, been really good. And they've sort of stopped these sort of things going through or raised concerns about it. And I think particularly the communications committee has been doing an excellent job, because they, you know, they basically deal with all anything to do with the internet. Any law that deals with the internet will go through them. And so obviously I have a lot of FaceTime with them. I go to a lot of their hearings, and they're doing a really good job of sort of forcing the drafters of the law to motivate why these things are being put in, why they're happening. You know, there's another thing that's, I mean, again, going sort of, this is sort of really deep sort of process in terms of how laws are created, but every piece of legislation needs to have something called a social economic impact assessment done prior to the bill being released or being drafted even. So the idea is that you need to say, like, and this was actually passed by President Zuma. You know, this was a requirement that came from the executive fairly shortly into his first term. It's like, this is what we need to do, good governance. And it's right. And the idea is that saying, if you want to change a bill, if you're going to introduce a new law, you first have to say, you can say, well, this is why we think we need to do it. And the socioeconomic impact assessment is then the backup to say, well, you think it's going to need to do it. Is it actually going to do what you say it's going to do? And if it is, you know, is there not a better way of doing it? So it's kind of meant to be the first test to see whether the bill should be passed or not. Okay. And at least two pieces of legislation currently before Parliament have not had socioeconomic impact assessments done, or they've been done in sort of way after the fact. And what's nice is the committees are saying, look, we are not going to let, because if they let that pass, you don't even need to have a constitutional argument to say whether a law is valid or not. You can go on administrative law and say, well, you haven't followed the correct procedure to enable this law.
Oh, wow. That's a nice little loophole.
You can just throw it out, you know. So it's exact, and the Parliament is acutely aware of this. And so credit to the departments and to the committees that are in charge of this, that they are holding the lawmakers to account and making sure that they follow the process and making sure that, you know, if there are problems, that they are being dealt with adequately.
So, Nick,
which is fantastic. So
one of the things,
it's not all doom and gloom.
That kind of segues into the next question I want to ask you is, when you talk about law and you talk about legislature and you talk about things that are forthcoming, people's eyes have a tendency to glaze over. I know when I tell my friends, hey, listen, you should really go and comment on this and say these sorts of things, they kind of just ignore me because they think that law is a problem that other people should have to deal with. So my question comes in two parts. Should people, the ordinary South African citizens sitting at home watching whatever it is people watch nowadays on TV, be concerned about this bill? And if they are concerned, where can they go and say something about it or try and get some changes to this bill, or if that's even possible?
Okay, so I think before I answer that, I just sort of wonder, I think there's a fundamental principle that is missing in our democracy. People seem to think that being an active citizen, getting involved with the laws in your country, basically happens once every 4 years when you vote. That's not the case, right? And I think a big issue that we do have is very much what you say, is that people are like, oh, well, someone else is going to deal with it, or there's nothing I can do, or they, you know, if you don't like what the government is doing, you have resources and mechanisms in place that you can do that are very effective. But it requires you to actually give a damn. And I think one of the problems of sort of social media really is that we've seen a rise of slacktivism. You know, it's very easy to give a like or share, reshare a post, you know, and feel that you've done something, but it's completely meaningless.
Or so sign an online petition.
You know, yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think broadly speaking, as a society, we need to start getting more engaged with the legal process and the laws that are being passed. It's not, I mean, one of the problems that we maybe have with our with the way that our legislature and our sort of our government is formed is that we don't have people who are directly accountable to us, right? Mm. So for your ward or for your province, you don't have a member in parliament like in the US or in the UK where you can write to and you can say, well, look, I want you, you are my representative in parliament, I want you to vote this way or that way. You know, kind of you vote for a party and the party then chooses who fills those seats. So there's kind of that aspect missing. But that being said, you do have, just because you don't have someone specifically that you can write to go vote a particular way or not, does not mean that there is no way for you to engage with that process. It's not actually just up to the MPs. And so that's what comes to what we call the public participation aspect. And this has to happen every single time a piece of law is passed, every time there's a bit of policy, and nearly nobody ever gets involved.
Even if there's like a slight amendment to an existing bill, they have to put it up for public comment.
Yeah, they have to.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like literally you cannot – it's one of those processes. It cannot – and again, we've seen attempts by certain elements within the government to – like they'll give like a week of public participation.
Yeah.
Or you know, and then the legislature says, no, do this properly.
Yeah.
You know, so again, the committees that are in charge of this are forcing people to follow the due process. So I think there's two elements to it. So, you know, get involved. And the way you get involved is by that public participation route.
Yeah.
If you go to Parliament's website, you can see everything that is available. It's all there. You can go and look at it. It'll tell you what, you know, what legislation, what bills are currently before Parliament, when are they going to be deliberated, and who you need to write to.
Yeah.
They say, this is the person that you can submit your comments to. And this is where we run into a problem. So not only do we not have active citizenry, but the other problem is that, and I think this is also fairly bizarre, is that the laws, generally speaking, are very difficult to understand. They're not written for the South African citizen. They're written for the judge or for the lawyers that will eventually be prosecuting those laws. And that to me is problematic because how are you as a citizen, one, meant to engage your constitutional right to public participation if you don't actually fucking know what's going on?
Well, I mean, right?
If you can't actually fundamentally understand it.
I mean, I was never taught the laws of my country in school. Like, I could not recite the laws to you.
No, but that in itself is not necessarily problematic. I mean, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of laws currently in place.
Yeah.
But the problem is that, well, if you wanted to know, you know, and they're all publicly available, you can go and get any piece of legislation and, you know, if you want to know what it relates to, you can get it and you can read it. And that's the problem, though, is that even with a fairly good level of comprehension of the English language.
Yeah.
It's incredibly difficult for the average citizen to actually understand what's going on with the laws. Mm. We at Michelson's and the legal profession generally is guilty of this. You know, I mean, it goes to contracts, it goes to everything. I mean, look at iTunes, look at their terms of service. It's 136 pages.
Yeah.
You know, no one's ever read that. No one ever will read that. And it goes down to this thing is that when people are writing these things, contracts, laws, bills, policy, they're writing for the judges and the lawyers who have very specialized degrees and very specialized understandings and are trained to basically read that legalese. And that to me is a problem because it should be, you know, you should be able to pick up any legislation, because this is a law that affects you, that you can go to jail with. It regulates your way that you can behave in society, and you should be able to understand what it actually says. And the only way that that is going to happen is if people use the mechanisms before them to engage with it and raise that as a comment. It is a very legitimate comment to submit to Parliament to say, I would like to give comment on this bill, but I actually don't understand it. That's a legitimate comment that you can make. Yeah, and that, you know, that is something in the Parliament. We had a really interesting, it was engineered by the Right to Know campaign. It was around the Films and Publications Amendment Bill.
Oh, yes.
I remember that. They had these public hearings, you know, all around. And one of the guys came and said, look, why are these hearings only happening in English? And why are they happening here in the city town? This is, you know, the vast majority of people in South Africa live in rural areas. They live in the townships. And they don't, their comprehension of English is not good. Why are these participation processes not happening in all 11 languages in South Africa? And why are they not going out to the people?
Yeah.
And that's that, you know, that, and that's absolutely correct. You know, we can't expect people to engage and get in with the law. One, if they're not going to understand it, but two, it's never made accessible to them. Okay. So given all of that, get involved, get engaged. The way you do it is through the public process. But also given these elements, what can you do? So don't do an online petition. It has no legal standing.
Yes.
Right? Parliament, the committees, everybody can fully ignore it. They don't give a damn. It has no legal standing. What you can do, though, which is kind of similar, is you can find an NGO or a non-profit or even commercial, you know, often big organizations, especially those that are going to be regulated by so something like the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Securities Bill, ISPA, the Internet Service Regulators, they have got involved. They will have comment. The cellular companies, all your ISPs, they will almost definitely be submitting comment on this bill because it's going to fundamentally affect them.
Yeah.
So what you can do is you can find out what are they doing about this. And you can lend your support to that aspect, because when it comes to making a public comment, you can say, you know, when you present to Parliament, because you give a written submission and you can also give an oral submission, part of that process is you would say, look, these are the concerns that we have with the bill. And, you know, we have had 10,000 people who are our customers, for example, or who have, you know, given us their power, basically, to say that they agree with our interpretation and our aspects of the bill.
Oh, wow.
And that's an easy way of delegating your authority, almost, is you can find one of these parties that are involved. So, like I said, I run a nonprofit, which is an industry body for game development. And whenever I'm writing comments on a piece of legislation that affects us, I go around to the various game development studios in the country or anybody else that may be affected by it. And I say, this is what I'm submitting. Are you happy for me to represent you? And it's almost like the opening line when I present this thing, as I say that, you know, this is AESA, this is what we do, and we have the support of, you know, 42 game development firms who are employing 256 people and represent over 100 million rand turnover every year.
Right.
No, that Parliament listens to that. They're like, oh shit, okay, cool. You know, so that is a way, if you don't actually want to get engaged, you don't want to read the law, you don't want to have to decipher it, you don't want to submit your own version.
Yeah.
Find somebody else who's championing the cause for you. And again, I think there is an opportunity here for corporate South Africa to get involved as well. Like, why can't you phone MWeb and say, MWeb, what are you doing about the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Securities Bill? Because it's going to affect you. And by virtue of that, it's going to affect me as your client.
And then
so I want to know what you're doing about it.
Mm.
You know, I think there's huge potential there for, you know, to if you really want to say, well, we care about what you're doing, you can rely on our legal team to voice your concerns with Parliament and affect the law. But again, it requires people to actually get involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to hold people to account. And that's difficult. You know, like, so people are like, especially for something that's, esoteric like a law, or there's this perception that it's difficult to understand. But like I said, there are opportunities out there. So find out NGOs who are doing stuff. Like there's the Media Monitoring Group. There is the Right to Know campaign. You know, there's all these NGOs who are getting involved, and they will, you know, they've got press releases. They've got all these things. So they're there. And if they run a petition, right, that's something that is worthwhile signing, because they will use that to then motivate their submission.
And that all then counts as saying, and that, we have 10,000 people on our side.
Ultimately, yeah, the thing that you need to do when you're signing an online petition essentially is you need to do a little bit of due diligence, do a little bit of fact checking, and you want to make sure that this, that the person organizing this petition is actually going to then do something with it.
Yeah.
Right, and what they need to do with it, which is incredibly important, is it needs to form part of that public submission.
Okay.
Right, it needs to form part of that process, because as soon as that is, it's for, as soon as it forms part of that public participation procedure, everything that is put before the committee that hears it, they have to deal with it. Right, so they have to look at it, they have to consider it, and they have to say, okay, you know, but if it doesn't form part of that process, you know, it
doesn't help anybody.
It doesn't matter. They're not required by law. Are they even going to see it? You know, but if you put it in front of them, if it's there as part of a documentation, you know, it's part of a submission, a formal submission that's made, then they are required by law to deal with it. They have to deal with it. They have to say, okay, look, somebody has raised this particular concern. Does it have merit? And you know, and then it's up. And the thing is that what's nice about the process is that they basically just ask the law writers to motivate. They say, somebody has raised this issue. What is your response to that?
Right.
And then it's up to the law writers then to come back to Parliament and say, well, this is what we're doing. So, I mean, just the process that's fresh in my mind, like the Films and Publications Board, the Amendment Bill, I raise concerns about the constitutionality of it. It's like, fundamentally, in a constitutional democracy, is it right that, you know, this branch of the executive can rate poems and artwork and all these sorts of other things? Like, fundamentally, should we be allowing this?
Yeah.
And this was put towards them. And then it was up to the FPB to justify its existence, essentially. They had to say, well, yes, we believe that we – I mean, they didn't, and this is why the bill hasn't been passed yet. They tried to sweep it under the rug, and the committee was like, no, but you still haven't dealt with this issue. So – you know, but that shows you the power that it can have.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, we are actually going to have to wrap this up, I'm afraid, Nick, because we are overrunning quite badly. But thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Not a problem. I have a tendency to ramble. Sorry.
As ever, when we have our chats, it's both lovely to hear from you, and I'm now going to build a bunker and stock up on water.
Don't do that. Go in comments.
Yes. And also, don't stock up on water. We've got water restrictions in Cape Town, man.
Don't send your water to Cape Town. All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Nick. It was really insightful, and we hope that the listeners have taken something from this, which is go out and say something about legislature. Mm. Get involved. Be an active citizen. I think that's one of the most important things with these bills that are flying around at the moment, is to be an active citizen. So thank you so much for joining us, Nick Hall.
Pleasure. Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me on.
And thank you so much for hanging around here, boss man.
I'm still building a bunker.
And for myself, Brendan Lotz, we'll see you all next week. Thanks for listening. And yeah,
cheers.
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.